So I got some very good questions. I got some very good questions at the end of the last lecture about more details about this relationship between the Poisson bracket and how you get quantum mechanics versus classical mechanics. So I think this is a really interesting topic that's pretty advanced. In fact, what I'm going to sketch for you, I think, is I don't even know if it's something that's kind of developed and published. But it's how I think of it, and it's an incomplete story, okay? So the idea is that, so this is a, not a recap, but this is a sketch. This is a proof sketch for deriving quantum versus classical mechanics. So the idea is you start with this idea of some algebra associated with these quantities x and p. And these are just algebra elements. And then you say, I'm going to assume that it's a Poisson algebra. And it satisfies a Poisson bracket. And again, this is just a mathematical structure. Which kind of comes from nowhere. Okay. And then you say, okay, so that means that I have a Poisson bracket between x and p, which I start as an axiom. And then I assume I can have other quantities, a, which are functions of x and p, and b, which are functions of x and p. And then the idea is that for any a and b, which are elements of this Poisson algebra, the Poisson bracket, the Poisson bracket satisfies, what is it, some four or five, I'd have to look it up. There's some four or five properties, defining properties. Okay, so it's, you know, there's Leibniz's law and the Jacobi identity. And
linearity.
Antisymmetry?
Yeah.
Is that it? It's just four of them? I think it's like a Lie algebra plus one other condition. Is that right? Anyway, it's closely related to a Lie algebra. And there's also this other condition here. So this is just a mathematical structure, which I don't know where it comes from. You just assume it. Okay, we start with an axiomatic structure like this. And then we make another assumption, which is we assume that now we start making physical assumptions. And mind you, this isn't like a proof. I mean, so Dirac talks about this a little bit in his textbook, but this is I think goes beyond what he talks about. You make some physical assumptions, like you say, let me assume that X generates translations. So actually, let me start with this. You have some quantity rho, which is a function of X, P, and a time parameter. So for some parameter t. And this is going to be our state, our description of a system. And then x generates translations in momentum. And p generates translations in position. And there's a preferred function h of x and p, which generates translations in time. And let me just throw, if one of you was interested in formalizing this, I think that'd be really interesting. So you make these physical assumptions, and then because H generates translations in time, that means that our state, d rho by dt, which I think is going to be a full derivative for reasons I can't justify, because I know it'll give me the right answer, you assume that this is true. So somehow we deduce that. And then I'm guessing this, and I don't know that this is right, but I'm guessing that when we say x generates translations in momentum, we're going to have something like d rho by dt what would that look like? Well, actually, what I want to see is, pardon me?
There, you meant delta rho, right?
Which one?
Delta rho?
Yeah, not partial d.
No, I don't.
No?
You just saw before that it was
I don't think I do want that.
But that's going to be only true if partial rho partial t is equal to real.
Oh, yeah, I think you are right. I do want delta rho, and I don't know why. That is going to give me the right answer, yeah. Well, let's see what happens. Let's see what happens. Because remember, this is a sketch. Okay, this is what it's like in my research group. I just throw some ideas out there, and I ask the students to figure it out. All right, so, and then I'm guessing there's some notion of translation where rho of x, p, and t translates. Say x plus a p of t under an operation. How will we write that as? I mean, what you want is something where you get e to the I p a acting on rho is going to generate a translation of rho of x p t, generates a translation of the form rho of x plus a p t. So this comment comes from a question I got from one of the students about how when we're writing down this mathematical framework and we're going to start thinking of it as a physical theory, I'll get your question in 1 second. Do we think of x and p as kind of dynamical variables or coordinates of the particle? How do we think of x and p? Because we're kind of at a very abstract level. We haven't specified quantum versus classical mechanics. And so my answer to that question was, think about x and p in terms of their effects on a quantum state without being committed to what that is, which means they're going to generate translations. And that also solves the problem with the Stone-von-Neumann theorem, which we'll get to. The question?
I think she just got it. So the second bullet is p generates translations in?
Position in x? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're generators of translations. So energy generates translations in time. Angular momentum generates rotations. The position up, the x generates translations in momentum, and p generates translations in position. So we have this very kind of, what's it called? Galilean transformations? Is there another word for it? The Galilean group? What's it called? Galilean transformation. So, a symmetry of the symmetries. What's the word I'm looking for? Is it? All right. Yeah, it's Galilean transformations versus Lorentz transformations. So we think about these algebra elements as being things that generate the appropriate symmetries. And then what I was mentioning at the end of the last lecture was how we make these assumptions. And then, how do we represent this as a more precise physical theory? Well, now you have to make an assumption about, in addition to all of these properties and this property, do I assume that x and p generate commutative transformations? Okay, so that would be a physical assumption. And so the idea is you say, well, let me assume that X and P are commutative, okay? Then what happens is, if yes, then you do some math, and this is math that's kind of beyond the scope of the course and actually, frankly, beyond what I can tell you off the top of my head, then what you get is there exists a representation of the Poisson bracket of any two elements A and B of the form dA by dx dB by dP plus dA by dP dB by dx. And then you say, okay, well now I have this quantity here. So I don't know what comes first here, but then what you can do is, this is where this full versus partial derivative comes in. So if you assume that d rho by dt is equal to zero, then you can do the chain rule, and you get dp by dt, which is equal to zero, you get d rho by dt dx by dt plus d rho by dp dp by dt plus d rho by dt is equal to zero. So that means that you have d rho by dt is equal to, minus, wait a minute. What did I do wrong here? D rho by dx. And this is d rho by dp, yeah. So you get d rho by dx, dx by dt, minus d rho by dp, dp by dt. And then you take this law here, and you substitute the Poisson bracket, this new representation we got, we get this representation from assuming commutativity. So then we can compare this with this. So, and somehow I have a minus sign this must be a minus sign. So there exists, obviously I skipped some math, some magic happened, and we got this representation, okay. Yes? Questions, comments, corrections? And then you can just read off, well, A is rho and B is A. So then, we'll take A to be H. Well, let me just write it out. So then we have, so for H comma rho, we get dH by dx, d rho by dp, minus dH by dp, d rho by dx. And then, we compare this with this, and then you recognize, well, d rho by dx is here, so for these things to be true for all rho and all h, it must be that dH by dP is equal to dx by dt. Okay, so then we deduce that for these to be true for arbitrary functions, it must be that, this is supposed to be a full derivative here because x depends on nothing other than time. So you get dx by dt is equal to minus dH, well, it should be actually plus dH by d rho by dp, and you get dP by dt is equal to minus del h by del x. And all my x's are x's and not q's, that's good. So the point is you get Hamilton's equations of motion from this structure. Now this is kind of a sloppy derivation because I just made all these mathematical assumptions and there was some hand-waving argument here and I got something you all knew.
I didn't understand what you, like here they are commutative with respect to what? You're saying that X and...
What I'm saying is if I start out with this community assumption is this. I have some function which describes my state. And the question is this. If I apply a translation in momentum and a translation in position, do I end up at the same place as if I change the order? So can I do the translation in momentum first, translation in position after, or not? So this, by the way, is a hand-waving piece. So there's some, what I'm trying to do here is something which I've never seen before and didn't think of until the question period after last class, which is, can we think about these P's and X's as generators of translations and bring in a physical notion of when we want to make a move where we assume non-commutativity or commutativity. And I'm trying to give an operational meaning to that assumption. So this is just a sketch. This is an idea about how to give an operational meaning to that in the absence of a full theory.
Okay, so the commutative transformation, like the, when you say that you assume that they are commutative, you mean that if I have some function and I translate, do a translation in the variable X, and afterwards a translation in the variable P, is the same thing?
Yeah, so P generates translations in position, and X generates translations in momentum. So the question is IXK e to the IPA equal to e to the IPA e to the IXK?
Okay.
And the answer is, for quantum mechanics, it's not, right? Because X and P don't commute. But in classical mechanics, it's true. So this is guesswork, and I'm just kind of going beyond the material here, trying to sketch out something which just occurred to me that I thought was interesting. So I think this makes sense, but I can't promise it, that we can think about what we mean by this non-commutative assumption at the level of transformations rather than at the level of observables. Okay?
Those guys only generate translations if they are operators, right?
Okay, here's what you're missing. It turns out that you can do classical Liouville mechanics in a Hilbert space. So the whole idea of using Hilbert space is actually you can do classical mechanics in Hilbert space. And the Hilbert space ends up being kind of an L1 space instead of an L2 space. And your states in that, your Hilbert space states correspond to the Liouville densities. And you can represent Hamiltonian evolution as a unitary operator acting on that Hilbert space of classical states. So all that structure of operators acting on Hilbert space vectors representing physical transformations, that's actually not quantum mechanics. That's classical mechanics. And it turns out that the difference between the two is that in classical mechanics, when you do classical Liouville mechanics in Hilbert space, you get that the position observable and the element which generates translations in momentum are different objects. But in quantum mechanics, they're the same operator. But that's a little bit, I mean, I can't really justify that right now. So I'm just trying to sketch out the notion of this argument, and I agree there's some loose ends here, which I'm leaving as an open problem. So we got Hamilton's equation. So now let's do the opposite. Let's say, instead of saying yes here, we say no. So now if no, they're not commutative, then what you do is you say, it turns out, and this is easy to prove, then it follows that the Poisson bracket of X and P, which we already decided is equal to 1 by assumption for both theories, ends up being proportional to XP minus PX. And then we just define this object. We introduce a new notation, and we call it the commutator. And it's just a mathematical symbol for this product, this difference of two products. So this is easy to prove. This just follows from the definition of the Poisson bracket. You show that if we have non-commutativity, then the only way we can have non-commutativity is if the Poisson bracket is represented as xp minus px, up to some unknown proportionality. And then once you have that, then you basically get the Stone von Neumann theorem, which tells us that e to the I x k, where x is a generator of translations, can be represented as a unitary operator acting on a Hilbert space. And you get that e to the I pa is also some unitary operator acting on a Hilbert space. So this is, I guess I'll call this UK and I'll call this UA. So in other words, we go from the assumption of non-commutativity in this abstract dynamical theory framework to getting the Poisson bracket being proportional to a commutator. And then we turn to representation theory and just mathematics and we say, well, if we have a set of algebra elements which are non-commutative, how can we represent them? And it turns out they can be represented as an algebra of linear operators acting on Hilbert space. So this is a representation of the algebra in terms of these infinite dimensional matrices on a separable Hilbert space. And then we get the Hilbert space structure of quantum mechanics. So that part is very clean because people have thought about it a lot because quantum mechanics is important. This piece is not as clean because people haven't worried about it so much. So the reason why I'm introducing it to you is because I think this is one of the most intriguing things in terms of kind of a partially, I think, undeveloped, not fully developed framework for understanding the difference between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics from an operational kind of axiomatic derivation point of view, where you have some very general mathematical framework or theoretical structure describing a class of possible dynamical theories, and then you add in some assumptions about commutativity in that theory, and then you get either quantum mechanics or classical mechanics. And then the piece that, to answer your question, the piece that has been developed by the mathematical physicists of the 1970s is that if you have this classical mechanical theory, which is Liouville mechanics basically, where rho is a probability distribution describing your knowledge of the position and momentum, then you can represent this all in Hilbert space with unitary operators and all that. So I think that's really cool.
So, so X and P form an algebra, right? And they form an algebra under the Poisson bracket being the multiplication, right?
One of the multiplications, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So you're defining another multiplication, mm-hmm. right? Which is that X times X times P. Okay, so where are you defining it? Like, in that assumption, like when you say, is it commutative or not?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Okay.
I think that answer is known, and I just don't know it off the top of my head.
Okay.
I think there's some well-defined sense in which you bring in another multiplication. You kind of supplement the Poisson bracket the Poisson bracket is one operation on pairs of elements from the algebra,
yeah.
And then we introduce another operation on pairs of elements, and we have to define it. And so we define it as either being commutative or non-commutative. But it's very much you're just adding more structure. And I don't know if I could be more precise right off the top of my head, but I don't think that's a problem. Does that help?
Kind of. I'm just wondering, like, you just, so when you assumed it's commutative or not commutative, you just say, okay, let's add this new multiplication.
Yeah, that was implicit in what I was doing.
But then, like, I don't see where you use that multiplication, like, in the if yes. See what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, I agree. I don't know either.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of what's one of the gaps in this. But I think that's a gap that's easy to, that's just a matter of looking something up. There are bigger gaps in here, which I don't know if the answer is even known.
Okay.
Or if there's a clear argument for. Yeah.
Is there a reason these algebra have two generators as opposed to three?
Yeah, so no. I mean, well, this is obviously if you have n particles in d dimensions, then you have n times d. So more generally, you would have x alpha j p beta k is equal to delta I delta j k delta alpha beta times 1, where alpha and beta refer to the particle numbers. So if I have n particles, and j and k just refer to the dimensions. So you would have, you know, x, y, z, or however many dimensions you want. And then it's only x's and p's, which are associated with the same particle in the same dimension, which are equal to 1, and all the other ones are 0. Which you can see from the fact that later on we're going to get the commutator out of it in the quantum setting. And we know for the commutator, if you have, and now we can just do a piece of quantum mechanics. I should call this K.
I guess I kind of meant like more as if there were like to be a third generator, like for each particle, like an XP and a.
Yeah, I don't know. I just want to be clear that I feel bad saying I don't know to so many questions, but I just threw this at you guys because this is something I want to understand more deeply. So, you know, there's some small part of my mind where I'm hoping that one of you geniuses shows up next week and is like, oh, here's the whole explanation that you were trying to do done correctly. That's what I would love to see. Because then I think there'd be a very clean story for how this fits together. And I don't feel like the story is super clean. So I'm just kind of throwing an open-ended fundamental question at you guys. That's the concept behind this kind of interlude. All right. An open problem in my mind. I mean, you know, maybe someone knows how to do all this and I just haven't seen their paper. Maybe it doesn't work. So it's just an open question for you to think about on the weekend. All right, so with that, I think we'll return to the regular lecture, which will be more clear. And and more well-defined. So we'll do some more elementary stuff. I'm very sensitive about making sure that in these initial lectures, as I review some stuff that's fairly basic, I'm very sensitive to the fact that I don't want to bore you guys, but at the same time, I want to make sure we cover a lot of the kind of basic material which you need to know. So we'll try and feel our way through that, but please give me your feedback kind of live. All right, so we did the von Neumann equation. I was just going to review two-level systems. Just some basic physics of two-level systems. And so we know that you can have, for example, spin half, where you have a spin vector, which is an operator-valued vector. And you know, I know you guys know all this stuff, and then you have a set of commutation relations. And then it's convenient to define SX as H bar over 2X and SY as H bar over 2Y and SZ as H bar over 2Z. And then you get, instead of this, you get the commutator of X and Y is just IZ, so we have no H bars anymore. And then we can define the zero state eigenstate of Z and the one eigenstate of Z. And this is a little bit confusing because the plus one eigenstate is labeled by zero and the minus one eigenstate is labeled by one. But that's just life. So where you would have SZ acting on plus a half is equal to plus a half H bar on the plus a half eigenstate. And this follows from representation of group theory. So this representation, when we're talking about, when we talk about X and P as non-commutative operators on a Hilbert space, and it turns out they're not self-adjoint because for technical reasons, but you can think of them that way for as a proxy, and you get this representation theory, and it's highly non-trivial for the infinite dimensional Hilbert space. But for angular momentum, you have these, you have this algebraic relationship for the commutator, and the representation theory is actually very easy to figure out. It's in your undergraduate textbooks. And you get these different irreducible representations of angular momentum. So you should know that stuff. I don't think I'm going to cover it. So here what we're doing is we're identifying the minus a half eigenstate and the minus a half h bar eigenvalue with 1 and minus 1, and the plus a half state with the plus a half eigenvalue with 0, 0, and plus 1 eigenstate here. And then you get matrix representations. So then in this representation, then, the Z matrix is represented. So in this basis, in the basis of the SZ eigenstates. And you get that X is equal to 0, 1, 1, 0. And you get that Y is equal to 0 minus I, 0. And then when it comes to the qubit, you have unitary transformations. Any U of T will just replace T with some parameter phi. So we have unitary transformations. Which are given by the exponential of minus I phi SZ over H bar, which is equal to minus I phi over 2Z. And then now physically we can generate that transformation if we have a Hamiltonian of the form omega naught SZ. And then the Z angular momentum operator generates a rotation around the Z axis. So then U of some time tau is equal to e to the minus I h tau over h bar, which is then equal to e to the minus I omega naught over 2 Z times T, which we can just define some parameter phi, minus I phi over 2 Z, where then phi, which is the angle of the rotation, so this ends up being the angle of the rotation, is equal to the strength of the magnetic field. So omega naught is the magnetic field times the coupling to the spin dipole moment. And then the amount of rotation you generate is the strength of that coupling times the time tau under which you allow that field to be turned on. So here, omega naught is proportional to some magnetic field strength and some coupling to the dipole moment of the spin of the magnetic dipole moment. And so in this way, by turning on a field along a certain axis, you can generate a rotation. And what this does is, if you start out where your spin vector is equal to h bar over 2 along x, and then you apply this field, it's going to generate a rotation of the spin vector to an angle phi in the xy plane. So this is how you go from some physical Hamiltonian to generate a transformation of the quantum system. So notice that I expressed it. So this is at tau equals 0. And then the S vector at some tau is going to be equal to h bar over 2 cos phi ex plus h bar over 2 sine phi ey. So the expectation value of the spin operator rotates, which is equivalent to the probabilities rotating around that axis. And here, a very useful identity for calculating anything like this is the Euler formula. Which is e to the I theta is equal to cos theta plus I sine theta. So I just want to give that as an example. And then more generally, it's good to know something about quantum and classical rotations. So any classical rotation which is defined as O3, a set of orthogonal transformations in three dimensions, can be decomposed. So let's call this R in O3. Can be decomposed as a series of rotations of three rotations. So these are the Euler angles. So you can describe any rotation by some rotation about z, followed by rotation about y, and then another rotation about z with three distinct parameters. And similarly, SU2 is basically a double cover of O3. And what that means is that any u, which is in SU2, can be expressed as uz alpha uy beta uz gamma, where uz alpha is equal to e to the minus I alpha as z over h bar, and uy beta this is equal to the exponential of e to the minus I alpha, sorry, beta sy over h bar. And similarly for gamma, it's a rotation about the z-axis. So any unitary on the qubit can be expressed as a series of three rotations, and you have a general parameterization as a matrix representation in the z basis for any unitary, which has the form e to the minus I alpha plus gamma. Over 2 times cosine beta over 2 e to the I alpha minus gamma over 2 sine beta over 2 and then minus e to the minus I alpha minus gamma over 2 sine beta over 2, and then e to the plus I alpha plus gamma over 2 cosine beta over 2. Okay, so that's the most general transformation of a two-level system or transformation of a qubit. And you can generate it by these more elementary components, by like turning fields on for certain amounts of time along the x, y, z axis. So that's how you generate an arbitrary rotation of a qubit or an arbitrary unitary transformation of a qubit. Okay, good. So the next piece is pretty fun. This is, we'll start talking about the state update rule. So that's something which is very interesting, and there are controversial aspects to it, so you might as well understand the details. So the idea is this. This is the so-called collapse of the wave function. Which is designed to take something that's very mundane and make it sound paradoxical, which isn't at all the case. So we saw previously that we had the Born rule to describe the probabilities of different outcomes. Under an observable A with spectral decomposition, and here I'll just use PM now. So PM is a projector. And that was where we had a box where the invisible system came into the box. We had our dial setting, and then we also had a pointer for the readout. So this is our setting. So implicitly, there's some preparation procedure which created this invisible system, which went into our box, and then you can either have the readout device have like a null position, which is no readout, and then the pointer swings to an outcome whenever a particle enters. But the other way to do it is you just put a little light on here. And then when the light goes off, it means a detector event happened, and then you look at where the pointer is pointing, and then, like we discussed earlier, these eigenvalues AM are labels for the pointer apparatus, for the pointer positions. And then if we repeat the experiment many times, we have the probability of M. You know, this is, and you should always write it as the probability of M given some preparation psi. And then you have, you know, some histogram. And that's the, these are the relative frequencies. Of the outcome set M. Notice I dropped even referring to A anymore. So A has units. A is going to be like angular momentum or energy, and it's indexed by M. All we really care about is the index. Okay, so then we have these probabilities of these different outcomes, which are indexed, and their relative frequencies, you know, given some psi, which is in correspondence with the preparation box. This is the go button. So some setting of the box refers to some preparation procedure. And then each time I press the go button, I get one outcome. I press the go button thousands and thousands of times, I get thousands and thousands of outcomes. And these are the relative frequencies. And of course, I have error bars. I have statistical uncertainty for finite samples. And then, of course, you have that the probability of M given psi, which is equal to the trace of PM this is equal to the limit where n goes to infinity of nm over n, where n is the number of times I press go. And nm is the fraction of times, is the number of times the pointer points to M. Okay, so that's very basic, but I just want to make sure we're clear on that. But now what you can do is, the next innovation is we can say, well, what happens if I have a box What happens if I have a box, a measurement box, that also has an output? So now a system comes in, the light goes off, and a system comes out. And of course, I can't see the system, it's invisible, but what I can do is I can chain together multiple boxes. Right, and then I can, each of these boxes is one of these. I can put the same setting or a different setting on the two boxes and look at what outcomes I get. How do I predict the outcome of the second box given knowledge of the setting and outcome of the previous box and, of course, potentially also knowing the settings of the earlier box? So when do I need to know the setting of the earlier box in order to predict this? And when can I predict the outcome of this box, which is predicting the pointer of the second box? When is it sufficient just to know the data about the first measurement box? And when do I also need data about the prior box? So that's all been worked out, and it's called the update rule. And I will now describe that to you. How many of you know this already? Luder's rule. Conditioning, okay, this is all new to you, as maybe almost all of you. So this is great. Great stuff. So so here's how this works. So we have Luder's rule. And Luder's rules about how to describe the quantum state, how to describe the system based on this information. So what we're going to do is we're going to call this state rho, and we're going to call this state rho prime, where here rho is equal to psi psi, and rho prime is equal to psi prime psi prime.
How do we assure that the state is still pure after?
I'll tell you. All right, so Luder's rule is, let's assume that we observed the pointer. And it was pointing to some outcome. The pointer pointing, I'm sure there's a better way to say that. We assume we observe the pointer pointing to some outcome M. So now M is some particular value. Okay. Then the input state rho goes to an output state rho prime, which is equal to, we'll call it rho M, which is PM rho PM divided by the trace of PM rho. So this is what's called a single shot setting. So single shot means that I'm just describing one setup. I'm not doing an ensemble here. So this is Luder's rule, and it's defined that we assume we found the pointer pointing to M. So now we can answer your question. How do we know the state is pure? Well, Luder's rule is let me just first give you the rules, and then later we'll see how we derive them. Second situation. This is case one. Case two, assume we do not observe the pointer position when the light goes off, when the detector light goes off. So you know the light went off, which means there was an event, but you didn't record. You were distracted momentarily, checking your phone, and you didn't notice where the pointer was, and it's already gone back to the ready position. So you're like, darn, I didn't see what the pointer pointed to. Now how do I describe the outcome? Now remember, you know the setting, and the setting fixes the operator by your laws of, because you know the laws of nature. So maybe you spent months building this apparatus, and what you put in here is a Stern-Gerlach device. And you know that what this dial does is it rotates the Stern-Gerlach device in some plane, and the input states are spin half particles produced by some oven. And then you know that this pointer points to the plus one and minus one, or plus a half, minus a half outcomes. So this is a two outcome measurement. And so this just has two different values. And this pointer is a continuum, which is you're rotating the Stern-Gerlach device. Assume this is Z. You're rotating the Stern-Gerlach device in the XY plane. How many of you know what a Stern-Gerlach device is? Okay, so I'm not gonna digress to it now, but that's something we should recap offline, okay? So a Stern-Gerlach device is a way to measure the spin component in the spin half system. So now you've built the device, so you know what operator A it's describing. But you didn't notice for this particular run what the pointer was. So what this is called a post-selected scenario. And this is a non-post-selected scenario. So in other words, am I describing the output state conditional or not on this pointer position I observed? So in the non-post-selected scenario, the rule is that rho goes to rho prime, which is equal to a sum over m, pm rho pm. So now I switch the order in which I'm teaching this material. So usually what I do is I go through the ideal axioms, and then I talk about describing noisy systems, systems where you don't have perfect knowledge. So sorry, quantum mechanically perfect knowledge is classically imperfect knowledge. And quantum mechanically perfect knowledge is described by the axioms I gave you. So vectors in Hilbert space or rank one density operators, unitary transformations, and projective measurements. When you don't have perfect knowledge about the quantum system, then you and we'll go through this next week, you use density operators which don't need to be rank one projectors anymore. Your unitary transformations generalize to what are called completely positive maps, and your projective measurements generalize to what are called positive operator valued measures. So that's how you describe the real world. So textbook quantum mechanics does not describe the real world, because in the real world, we always have imprecision. Just like Hamilton's equations of motion classically describe an idealized picture where you know we have perfect precision knowledge of the real variables describing position and momentum. And Liouville said, well, we never have perfect knowledge of the position and momentum. We always have some imperfect knowledge. And so he generalized the notion of position and momentum to a density function, a probability density function on position and momentum to describe the actual real world information I have. The same is true in quantum mechanics. We want to go from vectors in Hilbert space and unitary transformations to density operators and completely positive maps to actually describe the knowledge we have about the system and not imagine this, and rather than the idealized description, which we can asymptote to but never achieve in practice. So you can always get as close as possible to that description, but you never reach it exactly. So I haven't introduced density operators in the full glory yet, but it turns out that this is not going to be a pure state. So to answer your question, in this case, we don't have a pure state. And in this case, we do have a pure state.
But that only depends on the, because in both cases, the state was observed, right? It's just that we didn't.
Was it observed? Remember, what does observed mean? Observed means I acquired information about the system. So if the light goes off, I didn't acquire information about the system. I just know that I could have acquired information about the system. It's only if I actually see the pointer position that I've acquired information about the system. Okay? So it turns out that when I learn something about the system, and if I have perfect knowledge going in and I do a projective measurement, then I definitely have some pure state coming out. And I know exactly what pure state it is, and I'll show that in a moment. If I lose information because something happened and I missed key information, now all of a sudden my description of the quantum system is not ideal anymore. And this is, of course, the real world scenario where realistically, think about this pointer as being a continuum. And I only have some finite resolution with which I can read the readout. So there's always going to be, you're always going to have what's called a mixed state describing your actual information about a system due to practical imperfections.
I see that, but then the state of the system depends not on the system, but on what you know about the system.
Welcome to quantum mechanics. So there you go. So this isn't controversial. Remember, what I'm doing here is I'm describing the minimal operational interpretation of the mathematical elements. So I'm not imposing any interpretation on this. I'm avoiding making any interpretations here. So this is the correct description according to experiment of what happens in this setting. Now, more realistically, I created this kind of silly scenario where you built the device, it works properly, and you check your phone so you didn't see where the pointer was pointing, and you have to deal with that. Now, a more realistic scenario for that is that maybe the electronics that takes the data from your Stern-Gerlach device and produces this readout, maybe that malfunctioned. And so the pointer was in the ready position, the light went off, and the pointer didn't go anywhere. It stayed at the ready position. Then you say, oh, it malfunctioned. Now how do I describe the output state? Or another thing that can happen, and we'll see this in detail later, is that it turns out that when your quantum system, which might be, say, some free particle you're describing, suppose that it's in a vacuum, but there's some dust particle in the vacuum, and your quantum system is an electron, and it actually scatters off of this dust particle. But you don't know anything about that because you have no knowledge of the dust particle, the dust particle's position in the chamber. You don't know any of that stuff. It turns out that that scenario, describing the state of the electron after it's had some interaction, which we call decoherence, with the stray particle that you don't have in the environment particle, then your new description of the electron after that interaction is going to be exactly like this scenario, where it's like the environment did a measurement of the quantum system, but you don't know what happened to that dust particle. If you knew what happened to the dust particle, you'd be in this situation. If you kept track of the dust particle interacted with your system, you measure the dust particle, that's like knowing the pointer position. The position of the dust particle is the pointer in that case. But if you aren't tracking the dust particle because it's some unknown, that's like not knowing the pointer position, and that's when you get a more general description of your quantum state based on this density operator theory and this theory of mixed states, which we will do next week. Okay? Now, I'll go through this, and what I'm actually going to do for you is I'm going to derive this from the axioms under assumptions that directly represent the physical modeling of the situation. So you won't have to worry about taking this on faith. Because, I mean, one of the things that I'm kind of mildly proud of is that people usually present this as an additional postulate of quantum mechanics. But it turns out we can actually derive it under assumptions about the physical setting. So we'll do that next week. I'll let you think about it over the weekend. Thanks for all the great questions today. It's great that you guys already have warmed up to interacting so much. It makes the lecture a lot more fun for me, and I think better for you guys. So enjoy the weekend, and I'll see you on Monday. We'll have another double lecture.